Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber Podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and tonight we are going live with a friend of the pod, one of the best, Don Foster. Don, how are you keeping?
I'm not bad. I'm in London, plague capital of England, so having a lot of fun. But at least we're not Birmingham, which has been newly locked down.
Yeah.
So I can still go out if I want to, and I don't, because I'm terrified.
It's insane. Like it's a doubling of rates every 5 days. Did I read that right?
8 days in England at the moment.
Wow. I mean,
brilliant. Great stuff.
And at the same time, I saw headlines saying, you know, if you don't behave, there'll be no Christmas. How do we feel about this?
I mean, at the moment, I feel like most of my friends will be fine with Christmas being cancelled. Apparently, the first Christmas market in Leeds has been cancelled. There's talk of pantomimes being cancelled. But at the same time, you know, there was that big success of the Eat Out to Help Out meal deal where you got £10 off your meal. And then all of a sudden, England saw a big spike in affluent areas amongst people of an age who might eat out, say. And the government decided that they would follow up that, you know, tremendous success by trying to bring back theatre with a kind of buy one seat, get one seat free, you know, deal. Because I feel like, you know, if you're in a confined space eating together with a lot of people, you know, you're probably not going to catch an infection. So why not just sit in a room with people, you know, coughing for several hours? That's definitely going to go very well.
But the eat out to help out thing was a huge success. So, and I mean this as from an Irish perspective, we had a great laugh because we brought out our incentive for, you know, to drive internal tourism. But it's not really valid until October when it's going to be dark, raining, and miserable. And we all went, but can we not have that thing that they're having in the UK? And maybe we were wishing for the wrong thing.
Yeah, I mean, I've got quite a few friends who work in medicine. A lot of them are newly qualified, so they're doing a lot of coronavirus work. They're doing all the grunt work. A lot of them are working in, you know, the acute wards, and all of them said that they were less worried about the summer because, you know, a lot of people would be outside. You know, if they would go and see their friends, they'd be having a drink together in the park. They might sit in their back garden, etc. And they were more worried about the fact that that when it became darker, you know, people would go and meet each other in their homes. People would go back to the office. It would be, you know, people would be outside less. And the government clearly decided, you know, there's going to be a big second wave in winter. So why not just bring that forward a bit by cramming everybody into restaurants? So, I mean, economically, it was a success, but only because the government didn't want to bail out restaurants because that would be seen as socialist. Mm-hmm. So instead, they just put the welfare of, you know, staff and consumers at risk instead.
And can I just ask one personal question? When we spoke the last couple of times, you got a letter from the NHS. You were told you were at risk. What is the status now for yourself?
So people like me who were shielding are allowed out again. We haven't been told otherwise. So basically people who were told to stay indoors for 2 months, 3 months, have been let out again. We've essentially just been told to be a little bit more careful by our doctors. The government haven't really done anything. They haven't said anything. When it comes to people who are shielding, they've essentially just, you know, said nothing. And even when it comes to the usual flu vaccine, I mean, I'm normally eligible for the flu vaccine and my pharmacist will speak to me in August, September about getting them. This year, he says that he's really worried about the fact that A, they're widening eligibility massively, but also he hasn't been able to source any because all of his time has been spent trying to fulfill, you know, other medication requests, trying to deal with, you know, as a pharmacist,
yep,
acting like he normally would, but also the fact that he's had to majorly look into where he's getting his medicine from so that if a hard Brexit suddenly happens, you know, he doesn't suddenly have no stock and loads of very, very ill patients. You know, like, for instance, I've got epilepsy. If I go a day without my medication, if somebody with diabetes goes for a day without theirs, they'll end up in A&E. So my pharmacist has spent all of his time trying to deal with, you know, what's coming with Brexit, trying to act like a GP, and at the same time is very well aware that winter flu season is coming, and almost nobody will be able to tell the difference between normal flu, a slight cold, and coronavirus.
Yeah, you just couldn't without an actual test. Okay, so this is a recipe for disaster. But this and what I'm going to say now kind of sounds a bit petty. But how did you feel when you heard that they're going to break the law in a limited and very specific way? What did you think of the idea around the UK, as knowing you as a person are with your links to Ireland, your deep links to Ireland? How did you feel about that sentence?
I mean, it's just completely stupid. But I mean, when it comes to like the English government now, you realise that whatever they say publicly is very much not what's happening behind the scenes. So if they're publicly saying, look, we're going to break the withdrawal agreement, we're going to break international law in a very, very specific way, then it's very clear that behind the scenes that they are preparing for a full-on slash-and-burn policy. Thanks. And this evening, Boris Johnson had a Zoom call with MPs. He said that there wouldn't be any, you know, time for any questions afterwards. It all turned into a farce. He dropped out and had to be dialed back in while Michael Fabricant was singing Rule Britannia. But apparently, it was honestly a farce. Apparently, Theresa May had to try and stop a hard Brexiteer from taking over the meeting. You just wouldn't want to be in that Zoom group at all. And you had these 250 MPs who are all in this big bun fight, and apparently 80 of them are thinking of rebelling. I think at this point it's very, very clear that you know, the English government have decided that they want a hard Brexit, and everything that they're doing in public is to try and make the Irish government and the EU say no to them so that they can turn around and say, well, we had no choice, this had to happen. So it's essentially, you know, trying to force everybody else's hands just so you can get precisely what you wanted anyway. They want a no-deal Brexit. You know, they genuinely seem to think they can have whatever they want. And everything they're doing publicly is very, very different to what they expect to happen behind the scenes.
And both the Northern Ireland and the Scottish top legal people have come out and said that this is just, you just can't do this. Now, the Welsh haven't because they're captured, but Northern Ireland and Scotland have both said, no, you can't do this. How does that play out in regards to the UK Parliament?
It's really rough. I mean, essentially, I mean, The Welsh thing is essentially because in 1999, when, you know, there were votes on devolution, Scotland voted, voted and said, we want our own parliament. Wales was kind of hung. So Wales has a Senedd, which is not quite a full parliament. So it has some lawmaking powers, but not full lawmaking powers. So Wales is slightly different in that regard. And so it doesn't really have much political power. But essentially, you know, Scotland have said, no, this isn't going to happen. You know, Northern Ireland has said, no, this isn't going to happen. Boris Johnson thinks that he can try and push this through. I think the big issue is that basically what everybody really, really, really needs is, say, a Labour Party that was led possibly by, you know, a senior legal figure who could very, very clearly and openly say this can't happen and here's why it can't happen and be a bit more forceful. But Keir Starmer has clearly decided that Labour will, you know, only come out and oppose the Tories on very, very specific matters. And, you know, Keir Starmer was very, very pro a second referendum on Brexit. So he knows that Brexit is very toxic for Labour. So unfortunately, you know, when it comes to the English Parliament, you know, Labour aren't really doing anything. The Tories are trying to push Scotland and Northern Ireland as far as possible. And everything Scotland do, you know, Boris Johnson turns around and says, well, Nicola Sturgeon doesn't even want to be in this country. We shouldn't listen to her. So I think essentially what the Conservatives want is a hard Brexit, and what they're actually going to get is a complete breakup of the UK.
Mm.
What about this 2-week timeline that they can actually get this through within 2 weeks? Is that feasible?
There's absolutely no way that they can actually get that done. I mean, first of all, Boris Johnson is not going to work late nights.
he's the least working. Like, I mean, that's the one thing about him. He does less work than you.
You have me knocking myself out. And then I look at Varadkar, and I think he spends more time modelling suits and shoes than he does doing anything else.
Yeah, but I mean, like, you know, at least he's tall and handsome.
But I think you've said it before. If you give somebody the name, Varadkar has the name of being up early. That guy can sleep till noon every day and nobody knows.
Yeah, no, if you get a reputation for being an early riser, you can lie on for the rest of your days. But nonetheless, when it comes to this, and you see this, you know, Keir Starmer actually is well placed to take a shot at them, surely, Don?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of people, you know, especially the Scottish and Irish people I speak to, are very, very frustrated by how quiet Keir Starmer has been on this. You know, he is in the perfect position. He was a shadow Brexit secretary for years. He's now the Labour leader. He was the director of public prosecutions. He's supposed to be the highest legal mind in the country, and instead he essentially thinks that rather than try and, you know, look at the problems that we have right now, he's thinking about an election that is 4 or 5 years down the line, and he doesn't want to be seen to be pushing the Tories too much. And what that's meant so far is that the most forceful thing that he's done as Labour leader is demand that... Sorry.
The cat has made a cameo, as usual. Raymond is here.
So far, the most forceful thing that Keir Starmer has done is basically tell Boris Johnson that English kids had to go back to school at a normal time. That, you know, I think his exact words were, no ifs, no buts, no equivocations. I expect to see those kids back in school. And so English kids went back to school on Monday, and Monday afternoon there was a big news story that 11 schools in Liverpool had closed because some kids had tested positive for COVID. And so all of those kids and their parents would have to self-isolate for 2 weeks. So the most forceful thing that Keir Starmer did, you know, was essentially adopt Tory policy and tell them to do it, which immediately resulted in a massive, you know, clusterfuck. And instead, what the entire country wants to see him do is A, press him constantly on the fact that there aren't enough COVID tests, that, you know, we don't have enough measures in place, but also that, you know, we've had years and years and years to have a Brexit agreement put in place. And instead, Boris Johnson is messing around and trying to tinker around the edges at the very, very last minute. Yeah. It's like essentially he's rushing his homework, but Keir Starmer, you know, hasn't asked him to check and see if he's done it.
Can we just, accepting everything you've just said, and I do accept that Keir Starmer has really not held his feet to the fire, but on an international perspective, you know, the markets kind of priced in a no-deal Brexit maybe 18 months ago. They kind of knew that, look, we might as well take it into account that this is all going to be an omni-shambles. And then we had COVID on top of it, which made matters even worse. But the UK economy is tanked. You know, like, Don, your work has been about inequality, about housing need, about, you know, people who are struggling and people who need a break. Can I ask you, how bad is it getting, you know, in the real world, as opposed to the Boris Johnson, Dominic Cummings bullshit world?
It's it's completely terrible, to be honest. I mean, I do some volunteering in a food bank, and essentially the food bank are struggling massively, because basically for every food parcel they have about 80 people who want one. So they're all struggling massively. All the churches I know are trying to feed people, but also very, very well aware that by doing so, they're risking, you know, those people's health. At the same time, all of the people I know who rent their homes are absolutely terrified of getting evicted. There was a headline today, because basically for the past few weeks, the government have been very quiet about the fact that the evictions ban was ending mid-September. There was a headline from the government saying that the government would institute a winter truce, which, you know, surely sets up the entire situation as, you know, renters versus landlords in this terrible war. So, you know, there are so many people I know who are normally very affluent, who would be able to eat out without being helped out, who are now in rent arrears. And, you know, I've been doing some work with a trade union, and they have a benevolent fund where people who are struggling in work can apply for funding. And that's been completely overrun with applications. It's almost impossible to actually process them. And every trade union I know of is completely struggling, because they're besieged by the fact that loads of people have lost work, or if they're still working, they haven't been paid. And at the same time, you know, people are so skint that they're not even sure they can afford their union subsidies.
Yeah.
So everything's getting worse and worse. And, you know, I was in hospital for 4 days recently when I had a particularly bad seizure, and, you know, I was on the ward for 4 days, so I saw a lot of people come in and out, spoke to a lot of the doctors, and a lot of the nurses said that they were increasingly worried by the fact that they were seeing a lot of malnutrition cases.
Jesus.
When you already have a pandemic, and you know that the weaker you are, the more likely you are to develop complications. If you're also malnourished, then, you know, and you catch COVID on top of that, then it's
life limited conditions, as they say. Vicky, did you want to come in there? Sorry.
Yeah, because, like, I mean, I've lived in the UK before, and I always know when you're living in a country, the media is different. You get more accessible stuff. But there's, like, I don't get that sense here of any coverage of that scale of poverty. Like, I don't think we're hearing about that anywhere near as succinctly as you've just put it. Are people in the UK hearing about that? Is that being covered domestically?
I think we've got a bigger and bigger problem with the media in the UK, in that essentially, you know, you have a couple of radio stations. Now you've got Times Radio as well. So Rupert Murdoch has thrown a load of money into making a new radio station to try and rival BBC. I think the big problem is that we've got a lot of very right-wing newspapers. So you've got The Sun, The Times, The Telegraph. In terms of left-wing media, you've got, you know, The Mirror and The Guardian. I spoke to one of my editors at The Guardian the other day, who commissioned me on poverty, inequality, etc. And the first thing she said to me was that, unfortunately, because of, you know, the cuts of The Guardian, one of the first things that got cut were was her commissioning budget. So she can commission fewer pieces on that. So I think that you have a big problem with the fact that, you know, the right-wing media has a lot more money pumped into it, but also, you know, the left-wing media is covering the political bun fight that we're seeing every day, and also it's covering COVID. So things like, you know, the everyday problems that COVID's causing, like, you know, malnutrition, you know, money worries, people losing their jobs, the fact that, you know, poorer kids are falling behind far more than richer kids, the fact that we're seeing, you know, a lot more hate crime in the UK, it's just not getting covered at all, because, you know, basically there's a very, very narrow coverage on COVID, and it's, you know, mostly around how the government responds to it and what the numbers are every day, and less about kind of the tapestry of what it does to to people's lives every day. I think local press is doing a lot more on that. So I found myself reading like the Liverpool Echo, the Yorkshire Post, some Welsh newspapers and Scottish media a lot more. So I think local media is doing a lot more, and people I speak to are going to local media a lot more than they are than they usually would. And at the same time, you just had BBC taken over by a former Conservative candidate who is worried that the BBC is too left wing, and and Boris Johnson, you know, opened his Zoom call today by complaining that the media were biased against him. So I think that, you know, I think local media is enjoying a kind of renaissance. Hopefully it'll see the money follow as well. Independent media has been pretty good on it as well. But I think the mainstream media in the UK has a really, really big problem in terms of left-right coverage. But also the BBC is approaching a massive crisis as well. And that is definitely down to politics, and the Conservative Party are pushing that as hard as they can.
Talking about crisis, just here, Richard Chambers today uncovered a few documents, or they were released today from NFET, warning that there's going to be problems within our health service. How's the NHS looking for the winter?
It's looking terrible. So basically, I mean, I worked it out the other day that I've been in hospital 8 times during the COVID crisis, mostly just for A&E visits. But it does mean I've had 8 COVID tests and they're horrible. But basically, whenever I go in and speak to doctors, what they mostly report is that A&E visits are down. And there are 2 reasons for that. One, a lot more people are staying at home and playing fewer sports. So people are injuring themselves a bit less because they aren't traveling as much. They aren't jumping on trampolines. They aren't playing rugby as much. But there's also the worry that a lot of people just simply aren't going to A&E for things that they ordinarily would go to. And so things will get worse. But the other problem is that a lot of things are still done remotely. So apart from when I've been admitted to hospital for very serious reasons, the only time I've had to go into hospital to see a consultant was when I got a very weird type of pneumonia that they wanted to see for research purposes. So my epilepsy consultant I've spoken to on the phone, my physiotherapist I saw on a Zoom call. And the other thing is that basically the NHS has spent so much time focused on dealing with COVID that they're now having to catch up with all of their other work. So I get an annual MRI for this very rare genetic spinal condition I have. And because the NHS had to give that to me, they have outsourced it to a private company who run a private hospital in Canary Wharf. So essentially loads and loads and loads of private hospitals around the UK will now be benefiting from the fact that the NHS have no choice but to buy up their kind of low risk standard.
The cherry picking.
Essentially the NHS has done all the grunt work. They're doing all the high risk, really, really hard work. Every consultant I know has, had to do all sorts of stuff with COVID. They've worked really wild hours. And then they had to give all of that money to private hospitals. And at the same time, Boris Johnson has this new idea that he's calling Operation Moonshot, where he basically wants to develop this this wild test that you basically spit on like a pregnancy test, and within 8 to 10 minutes it tells you if you've got COVID or not, and you do that every day and then you go to work. And he's essentially come up with this like wild, imaginary scenario. So he's clearly had a fever dream and has decided to basically spend $100 billion on that.
$100 billion
on that, when the NHS England budget every year is 114 billion. So, you know, it's 14 billion shy of the entire NHS operating budget that he wants to give to this wild fever dream. It's definitely worth like looking up Operation Moonshot, because
I have heard about it, and it's insane, Don. And it reminds me again of that Trumpian thing where he goes his upcoming one of the vaccines that is promising. I think he called it Operation Silver Bullet. You know, let's give it a cool name. You know, let's give it like it may not work for shite, but let's have it have a really cool name and pretend that it does.
Only nerds could do that, Tony. Like cool people couldn't do that.
Yeah, exactly. It was the sort of shite I'd come up with, Martin. I'd be going, let's call our next episode Silver Bullet. But.
Do you remember when Newt Gingrich was running in the primaries against, for the Republican primaries, I can't remember, was it 2012 perhaps?
Yeah, it was.
One of his big plans, now he didn't get it obviously, one of his big plans is he's going to build a moon base. And I remember watching the Fox News presenter be like, this is a fantastic idea. Like, let the man build a moon base. And I was like, oh my God, did his 10-year-old son write this,
you know? and Saoirse, Trump came up with Space Force. It's like, you know, so how far have we come on? I suppose, Don, just to bring it to, I know we get very insular here, but to get to the idea, okay, so the idea, the UK is saying, no, you can't do this because that will impede on our ability to have state intervene in the markets, you know, so you know, give benefits to certain companies, you know, it'll hurt our Singapore on the Thames nonsense, it'll hurt all our competition things. And but is any of this actually true, or is it just simply a right-wing fever dream, as you kind of referred to earlier, that the idea that the UK, when they decide to go alone, that it will still be, you know, Great Britain with a capital G, or is that long gone?
I honestly think that, especially for people like Boris Johnson, so, I mean, it's very well known that Boris Johnson, when he's a Telegraph columnist, wrote two columns, one where he backed Brexit and one where he was against it. And I think for people like Boris Johnson, they're genuinely terrified of what happens when Britain leaves the EU. I think that a lot of Conservatives haven't admitted to themselves that they genuinely don't know what happens next and are quite scared of it. Whereas you have others who are essentially kind of caricatures from Brideshead Revisited, who are convinced that the second that they leave the EU, that will bring back the Crusades and everyone will dress like Henry VIII or something. I'm terrified to live in England when this happens. Luckily, I've got two passports and I'm just fleeing.
I will pick you up from the airport.
But I think for a lot of them that they are genuinely scared of what will happen next. And I remember speaking to some MPs' aides, and I remember one of them said in May that they felt quite bad for thinking about the fact that a lot of MPs felt quite relieved that there was a global pandemic, because it took some of the headlines away from Brexit for a bit, and you know, a lot of MPs thought maybe this will give us some wiggle room. We'll deal with this horrible pandemic, and then we'll come back to Brexit after a couple of years, you know, when we've got more time to think about it. And instead, we've just been railroaded into keeping to these timelines, despite the fact that, you know, the entire country, you know, the entire world is shut down, and the entire country is in lockdown and dying around us. So I think a lot of MPs are genuinely terrified about what happens next. They have no idea what the United Kingdom will look like alone. They've got no idea whether or not, you know, the UK will stick together. And, you know, I think for a huge number of MPs, especially in Westminster, who are dotted around around the UK, they're genuinely worried about whether or not the UK will stay together. Mm. Nicola Sturgeon has never been more popular. All of a sudden, you know, people in Wales are suddenly turning around and saying, we're actually quite sick of England's crap. Maybe we should look again at proper Welsh independence. And obviously, you know, the idea of a border poll has come back up again. So I think that a lot of MPs didn't think it would get this far, and a lot of them are now terrified that it has, but they've committed themselves too much. And, you know, they have these constituents to write to them constantly, and everyone's too scared to actually, you know, call each other's bluff and say we don't know what's going to happen and we don't know what we're doing, and also everybody's dying.
Yeah, and I suppose that is it. I keep hearing this highbrow conversation about, well, they're inhibiting our right to, you know, competition. They're inhibiting our, they're going to say we have to play by their rules. I actually don't think any of that really matters. It's I hate to say this in such terms, but it's always the case with lads. You know, it's a willy measuring, and they're losing. And the simple fact is that, in the grand scheme of it, markets price these things in, and they move on, and they have priced this, and they've moved on. From an Irish perspective, it's actually really bad news in many ways. You know, for our economy, for the land bridge, for all of those things, but in the grander scheme of things, it's going to actually force a lot of issues that we should talk about as an Ireland, as a country, as an island. It's going to force those conversations to happen. And I'm kind of glad for that in a way, but I'm also really, really, really disappointed that the UK as a whole has been driven by this group of ERG wingnuts. And that's who they are. They're wingnuts who are always opposed to the European idea. And let's just hope that as it comes down to it. Ladies, anybody else want to come in there at all? Sorry, Martin.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, Ireland lost Phil Hogan. And I want to know, is that the huge big story in the UK? Are you all now delighted that Phil Hogan is gone? It makes Brexit so much easier for the British.
I don't think it does. I think the thing that makes Brexit hard for the British is the English, essentially. I mean, what makes Brexit so hard is that essentially you had a ballot. I remember going to vote that said, should we leave the EU, yes or no? And everybody who voted yes and everybody who voted no had a completely different idea of what they wanted from that outcome. So, you know, David Cameron, you know, it was one of the stupidest things he'd ever done. And, you know, the guy apparently shagged a pig's head. But essentially, you know, David Cameron. Well, I think we've all learned a lot tonight. So, are you sure it's a tortoise shack?
Dawn, please. Like, I was speaking metaphorically.
So essentially, David Cameron agreed to the referendum on whether or not we should stay in the EU because he had two MPs, I think, who were threatening to move to UKIP instead of staying in the Conservative Party. So he held a huge referendum for the sake of keeping one or two MPs, one of whom, you know, crossed the floor anyway, and then was immediately replaced by a Conservative. So he held this just to try and keep the Conservative Party together when he didn't especially need to anyway. And then the second that he lost the referendum, he stood down. That, you know, everyone remembers the famous clip of him walking away after announcing that they'd lost the referendum, therefore he would stand down, not realizing that his mic was still on, and humming to himself because he clearly didn't care. It didn't affect his life. Very little ever had. He's a very privileged man, and you know, he was replaced by Theresa May, who then had to try and turn around and say, right, we voted for X, but None of us know what X is, so let's try and work this out. So she had to then try and work backwards and try and work out what the country wanted. None of the MPs knew what they wanted, so they all fought for years. Then the entire country started fighting. Then you get yet another posh privileged man who comes straight in, whose only slogan is get Brexit done. And absolutely nobody knows what it will look like, because no country has ever left the European Union before. And I think basically the English are terrified about the fact that, you know, when it eventually happens, and I think it will, Britain will leave the EU, and they'll suddenly realise that actually the EU don't care that much, and they'll suddenly realise that firstly in the scheme of European Union, Britain are very small, but also in terms of the world, they're even smaller. They're a tiny, tiny country who make almost nothing, and if you look at Scotland, if you look at Ireland, there's a lot of trade, there's a lot of oil, there's a lot of tourism. And then you look at England, and over and over again, Boris Johnson says, well, people come and see the Queen, they might come and visit London, or I don't know. So, the economy's tanking because of COVID anyway. Mm. It'll tank for more once Brexit happens. And then you have the break of the UK, because it's not going to hold for much longer. Because you have these people who basically spent 4 years being told over and over again by politicians that they are bitterly divided between either leavers or remainers, when actually everybody's, politics are on a spectrum, everyone's opinions are on a spectrum. But instead, we've had this kind of, internally divided politics that's just been pushed back onto us by MPs for years. And, then you have a pandemic, and Boris Johnson decides to spend all of his time screaming at Nicola Sturgeon that she just wants to leave.
Linda, you wanted to come in there, sorry.
Yeah, John, can I just ask a question around the Good Friday Agreement? Is anybody talking about the Good Friday Agreement over there? Like, it just seems like it's just a lot of in-squabbling, and nobody's really looking at the implications for Northern Ireland. And I know the Northern Ireland Assembly are now jumping up and down about it, but you're not hearing a huge amount coming out from London about it, so.
I think that people were a bit were more before. I think since Boris Johnson's come in, it's been put on the back burner. He doesn't really care about it. He's written ridiculous stuff about the Good Friday Agreement in the past. Michael Gove wrote this terrible pamphlet that I think is freely available online. I'll send it to Tony so he can tweet it, about the Good Friday Agreement, where basically Michael Gove said that it should never have been signed. It was a travesty. It was awful. England should never have given up Northern Ireland. It should never have opened the border, etc. And I think another big issue is that Brandon Lewis is, I think most Tory ministers have been pretty bad, but Brandon Lewis is particularly bad. He doesn't really care about the Good Friday Agreement. He's never been particularly committed to any of the briefs he's had, and he's now been given one of the most important of his life. He was a transport secretary, and he was probably more committed to that role, which, far fewer people's lives depended on. So I think you have a very, very bad minister in that role. And at the same time, you have a pandemic, which the government are using to try and, draw attention away from this looming crisis. But it also means that in health terms, I think this is really key as well. Basically, we talk about Brexit over and over again for years, and then all of a sudden a pandemic happens, and so you start talking about health authorities. So you talk about, you put rates in Northern Ireland, you talk about rates in Wales, you talk about rates in England, you talk about how many cases there are in Scotland, and all of the different health boards are completely devolved, and so they stop speaking to each other. And that means that it also kind of draws attention away from the fact that you have this looming kind of crisis. So I think that hasn't helped a lot as well. I think it means that basically the nations have kind of become a little bit more insular, especially England, because you're looking at health problem and reporting inwardly. But I think the big issue is that basically everybody who, the people I know who take the Good Friday Agreement the most seriously are the Good Friday Agreement babies. They aren't people, you know, they aren't the politicians who are in their 60s, their 70s, etc., who should remember these things and should think more carefully about them. Instead, you've got people like me who were like 8 and 9 years old when it was signed, who know a lot more, appear to know a lot more about it than any of our politicians. So I think, you know, basically you have this big issue where English politicians don't care and have had years and years and years to, you know, teach themselves about it. And, you know, to be honest, you know, Sinn Féin, if Sinn Féin had taken their seats in Parliament, nothing would have changed. Michael Gove wouldn't suddenly have read the Good Friday Agreement if Alicia McCallion had been sat opposite him. You know, the DUP have taken their seats, and surprisingly enough, you know, even when I speak to Tory MPs, they still ask which ones are the DUP again. You know, and you have English Tory MPs who know so little about the Good Friday Agreement, even though they were in the
we get that all the time, Dawn. Sorry, Vicky, go on.
Yeah, but this is the thing, right? Because what I was going to say originally was, like, all of this, we expect that from the Tories, and it just makes Keir Starmer's behaviour even worse, right? It's more of a betrayal because he does know better. And he knows better on this. Like, he was the independent reviewer of terrorism legislation in Northern Ireland. He knows Northern Ireland. He knows what the issues are. He knows what's at stake. And it's so hard to watch, even from here, like, how he is betraying the British public. You know, I don't want to expect any less from the Tories, but I kind of expected a little more from him.
Yeah, I mean, it genuinely does feel incredible that at the moment it feels as if Nicola Sturgeon is the leader of the opposition when she isn't even in the same parliament as Boris Johnson. Nicola Sturgeon is doing more to hold him to account, to, you know, talk to him about the Good Friday Agreement. You know, I mean, every Wednesday, Keir Starmer has the opportunity to physically stand opposite Boris Johnson, you know, not even on a Zoom call that he can dial out of, and say, look, I understand the Good Friday Agreement. I understand Northern Ireland. I can talk to you about these issues. You know, have you seen what's been happening in Derry recently? You know, I was trying to think of stories from Northern Ireland that I'd read recently, but all I could think about was that kid driving the lorry. But, you know, Keir Starmer could do this. And instead, what he's focused on is trying to appear as essentially a surrogate Tory party. It is very, very strange to basically go from Jeremy Corbyn, who was very ideology-led, but would basically try and hold Boris Johnson's feet to the fire while refusing to stick to parliamentary procedure, to move to Keir Starmer, who is all about kind of personal image and obsessed with parliamentary procedure, and who knows all of this legal stuff, and has the perfect opportunity to say, hey, look, I know all about Brexit. I'm going to hold you to account on Brexit. Or, hey, I know all about terrorism. I was a director of public prosecutions. I was a lawyer for 30 years. You know, he could do all of this, and instead he appears to be doing absolutely nothing. And it genuinely feels as though essentially the SNP are the only people holding the Tories accountable in Britain at the moment.
Saoirse.
I was just wondering, Dawn, have you any sense that the Tories might be just trying to bluff in order to get a different deal, or do you think the hard Brexit is what they want?
I think the hard Brexit has always been what they wanted, but I think the only issue is that none of them know what a hard Brexit looks like. I mean, I went over to Brussels and spoke to lots of different MEPs from lots of different parties in Ireland and Britain, and loads of them had had meetings with lots of different officials, lots of different aides, lots of different Tories, lots of different people from all sorts of countries. And absolutely nobody had any idea precisely what any of the Tories thought a hard Brexit was or would look like. And I think that essentially, you know, for every Tory MP, there is a different idea of what Brexit will look like. And all of them think that they're going to get the same one as, and, you know, and the even the European Research Group, who've been researching in Europe for years now and still apparently haven't finished researching it, even amongst them, there's a lot of discord, and none of them appear remotely clear on what they want, on what's going to happen. And, you know, very simply, it's because nobody's left the EU before, and they, and none of them really seem willing to accept that fact. So none of them are willing to, you know, have the humility to say, we don't, look, guys, we don't know what's going to happen because nobody's done this before, but here's what we'll try and do. Because instead, they're all fully ensconced in this kind of rule Britannia kind of wild, mad patriotism. And Labour are just kind of sitting back and saying, well, we don't want to push them too hard because we also want to win an English election.
I'm so glad you said that, Don, though. But the whole fake outrage around the last night at the proms and the rule Britannia, all of that nonsense about how they're fighting these battles, what a load of tosh to put the to put a Toryism on it, you know? There's, it's just not like, I mean, I we sit here, like, I admit I'm a political nerd, but I sit across the water and I absolutely despair for at least be honest. But there's no honesty in this argument. It's an argument about an empire that no longer exists, and to, you know, it's two world wars and one world cup. And it's all this nonsense. And we just need to understand what it means in terms of trade, economics, and actually, more importantly, what it means for the people. And I think you've summed it up very well in terms of, look, inequality is getting bigger. Deprivation is getting worse. And it was already in a bad state before this started. And this is where we are now. And anything else, all of this other charade of, you know, who, as Martin put it, who's the next trade commissioner in the EU? It doesn't really matter if it's not putting bread on the table. Look, in terms of the podcast that's going to go out, I'm going to leave it there. But there are, if you don't mind giving us a couple of more minutes, I'm going to ask a couple of, if anybody else wants to ask a question. I know Anne-Marie and Maeve are there and a few others. So, guys, put your hands up or just unmute your mic if you don't mind. Or actually, anybody else, Saoirse, Linda, Vicky, come on in because it's great.
But isn't the kid driving the truck, is not just a perfect example of where politics is right now? Like, Boris is driving the truck.
I'm a fan of that kid. I'm also a very big fan of accusing my friend who grew up near Dungannon of being that child.
but in Ireland, it's more like a train, and you've a Taoiseach pulling one way, one end, and a Taoiseach pulling on the other end, the other way. But in England, it's just a truck that's going to go off the road and kill somebody. You absolutely know it is.
Yeah, but at least we're not. Like, I just think that one of the saddest things about this is all the work that's not getting done in Britain at the moment.
Yes.
All of the everyday policy that's not getting focused on. At least in Ireland, we have some movement on some of that stuff because we're not, you know, we're not torn between Brexit and COVID and to quite the same extent.
Hmm. Don, go ahead.
I think the big difference as well is that, like, people are rooting for the kid who is driving the truck, whereas nobody is rooting for him.
That's it in a nutshell. We know and actually, funnily enough, you know, the one thing about Brexit is we've never rooted for England in our lives, but we're sitting there going, oh, come on, guys, get it right, you know.
I do want to complain about one thing, and, you know, you mentioned briefly about how, you know, England just needs to focus on trade and economics, and obviously with it almost being deadline time, they announced their big trade, the big list of who was on their trade board, you know, I think last week. And the biggest, there's been this huge argument in England about the fact that Tony Abbott has been included because A, he's Tony Abbott, B, he's a misogynist, he's homophobic.
Oh yes, I saw that.
But I mean, I saw a much smaller argument made by, you know, me and a few other people about the fact that there was nobody from Northern Ireland on there whatsoever. You know, I saw somebody from the Northern Ireland Retail Consortium say, guys, have you forgotten about the North? But they somehow remembered Tony Abbott. And I think, yet again, it just shows that basically, you know, it's as Tony put it, it's all about Willy Wade. It's like the Boris Johnson says, right, I'll get Tony Abbott. He's a big name. We'll put him on there. And nobody has thought, who should we have on this board? Let's get the basics right. Let's get one person from each of the four nations, shall we, guys? Instead, it's all about who can we get to go to the top of our press release? And we'll think about the detail later.
We have that something similar here, except for our Taoiseach is currently dealing with a Taoiseach who thinks he's Taoiseach, and no one in the country can tell the difference at the moment. I just think from an Irish perspective, looking across the water now, we've kind of known, which was very funny to hear some people in the UK. Brian Cox was so funny saying, this is the moment, you know, what will we do? Saoirse, you're laughing. You saw the tweet, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was... Go on,
like,
yeah.
The rest of the world is like, oh, Brian, like, what Britain, what history of Britain have you learned? Like, it was nonsense. And like, even some Irish media, I think, were, I don't know, were they feigning shocked at what was about the whole, oh, we're just going to break the law in a very limited and specific way. But I feel like most of the world is kind of like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Read
junior cert leveling history and you will know, yeah, that the UK has ripped up agreement after agreement, and like, we're sitting here in the centenary of all of these, you know, the Balfour Agreement, how they redrew the maps of the Middle East. All of this was done, and you're going, yeah. And what that meant was actually negating on a lot of international things. Don, last thing, and I mean this in a personal nature, as someone you said earlier, you alluded to the fact that you've been 8 times in hospital. It hasn't been an easy lockdown. We worry about on this podcast a lot about how in Ireland, how these people are being treated in terms of mental health. How have you found the NHS, and how have you found the wraparound in terms of, you know, people following up and the neighbour, the spirit and resolve? Is that holding up? Because it's hard.
I think I'm quite lucky in some ways because some of my illnesses are relatively easy to treat in terms of kind of, they aren't easy to control, but they're easy to treat. So like epilepsy, I've got this genetic condition called schwannomatosis, whereas I've got other friends who have mental health problems who struggled anyway because the NHS always had big problems with mental health provision. And I've got, you know, I think I'm used to basically managing my own health conditions. I'm used to calling a GP when I know I need a GP's appointment. I go to A&E when I know something isn't properly right. Whereas I think that my friends who have mental health problems have struggled a lot more because they've either had to see their, you know, usual therapist via Zoom, which they've struggled with. They've also found that basically the NHS waiting list for mental health treatment are much, much higher. The people I know who work with charities that deal with loneliness have been completely inundated because obviously for people who live on their own, who then have to work from home, essentially you're not seeing anybody. So you're not seeing your colleagues anymore. You aren't seeing your friends anymore. You're basically sat in a room all day in front of a computer, and then you look at a different screen, and then you go to sleep, and then you don't see anybody. So I think I've been quite lucky in terms of knowing that I've got neighbours who'll check on me. I basically had a very, very bad episode where the police were called because somebody in the street was concerned about me. The police, because the English police are awful, thought I was drunk. But then another passerby said, no, I think she needs a paramedic. Paramedic immediately said she's having an epileptic seizure. So luckily I was taken to hospital, not to a police cell. But I've seen so many other people who've had much worse health problems, who've really, really struggled to get the care that they need. So my friend's mum had a 3-month gap between breast cancer treatments when it should have been a 1-week gap. I've had other friends who seen waiting lists grow and grow and grow. I mean, I was supposed to see somebody about my hearing back in April, and now I was due to see them in November. That may change again. The big thing is essentially the NHS are trying their best to move things online as much as possible, but that's not always possible. And, you know, for instance, it can also backfire massively. So, for instance, when I saw my physiotherapist on Zoom, I mentioned that I felt like I had a trapped nerve in my shoulder. She told me some exercises to do, made me do them on Zoom to deal with the fact that I had this bad shoulder pain. And as soon as I got off the Zoom call to her, I felt a lot worse. I was in so much pain. My shoulder got worse and worse. Every time I kind of took a breath in, it hurt more and more. And after 5 days of basically not being able to get out of bed, I Googled to see what might help. And it suggested some very worrying kind of possibilities. So I called the NHS 111 service, which is one step away from 999, and basically told them that I felt like I had a trapped nerve, that it hurt more when I breathed in, that I hadn't been able to get out of bed. And they immediately said, go straight to A&E. We think you're having a pulmonary embolism. And I went to A&E, stupidly Googled that on the way in. And the first thing I saw on the NHS was that apparently if you leave it, you have a 1 in 3 chance of survival. Got to A&E and they x-rayed me and said, it looks like a pulmonary embolism. We're going to get you seen as soon as possible. Luckily, it was atypical pneumonia. But again, it was like if I had been seen by a GP instead of by a physiotherapist over Zoom, then the GP would have been able to listen to, like, A, look at my shoulder, listen to my breathing, immediately ask questions such as, does it hurt more when you breathe in? Like, what causes more pain? But because I saw a physio over Zoom, it essentially meant that I spent 5 days in bed with pneumonia getting worse. So I ended up having to take 4 different types of antibiotics for 2 weeks in total, and had to go back to hospital 5 times for lots of different blood tests.
I remember the incident, and I remember being absolutely useless in terms of empathy. and you were like, yeah, "No, Tony, it's much worse than just a trapped nerve."
Yeah, I've had that pulmonary embolism, so I do know what it's like. Yeah, it is seriously, seriously bad.
No, Vicky, did you want to say something? No, it's okay. Sorry.
It also freaked me out because I've got a very, very healthy friend who basically, the only reason I Googled it was basically because a very healthy friend of mine who runs marathons, and is 30, had a pulmonary embolism just out of the blue at work one day last year. And I suddenly thought, didn't he just suddenly start feeling like he had a sore shoulder? And then he was in hospital for 3 weeks. And I just thought, maybe I should Google this. And it was one of those annoying things that basically the NHS were trying to do their best, but unfortunately made it worse because they're trying to do this wraparound thing via Zoom and phone calls.
Yeah.
And you can't always expect patients to report things properly. Patients are, you know, especially women, are quite reticent to say things. And, you know, GPs have I think, what I could always ask Leah Varadkar. GPs have, I think what they call the doorknob question, which is basically what the people, just as they're leaving the doctor's office, will often ask a question. And that question is what they really wanted to mention, or what they knew they should have mentioned, or what will be the most serious thing. So often what patients, you know, mention as an aside is the most important thing of all. But I also understand that Leah Varadkar has, you know, come out with some really, really exciting and important info today, that apparently it, you can't run a business with dead
if your staff are sick and the people are dead, what can you do? Like, you know,
his empathy level is right up there with yours, Tony.
No, Martin, I have never said dead people. I've just said underproductive economic units. Okay, let's be clear on this. Like, if you're not, like, let's at least harvest the organs. Look, I'm gonna knock